You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
All right, so I ran and got my recorder because Ben, say hi to the people, Ben.
Hey, people.
Started pouring a drink. It was supposed to be a gin margarita. And then what happened?
Well, because I thought we were in this like Airbnb and
Superfly, think cribs.
And so the first thing that I do is, of course, raid the pantry just to see what basically just the stuff that other people left. And I found a mostly drunk bottle of gin and what I thought was margarita mix in the pantry, but it turns out it was not margarita mix. It is actually like pre-mixed margarita. And I didn't find that out until after I had poured them.
The reason why this is documentary worthy is because everyone I've talked to have said, be careful how much you drink out there. The altitude will really mess you up. You're going to get really drunk really quickly. So it's ironic a little bit that the first drink I have is a drink that's stronger than I expected it to be.
Yeah, well, to put you in the mood, I guess.
Okay, well, here we go. Cheers.
Cheers.
Okay. Oh my god, this is dangerously like
easy to drink.
Hey everyone, this is Aisha. It is Wednesday, January 24th. We are in our very lovely house that we're, Airbnb house that we're renting here at Sundance, along with Marilyn. Hey, Marilyn.
Hi.
And Dana Stevens is here with me, our Slate's lovely movie critic.
Hi, Aisha.
Welcome, Dana. Wait, is this the first time you've been on our show?
No, I did a segment before. I can't remember
what
it was on.
Harvey Weinstein.
Oh, yes, we talked about Weinstein.
Yeah.
Well, welcome back.
Yes, I have to correct you with home. This is better than a home. We're in like a chalet or a lodge or something like that. This place is beautiful.
This is so true. And the mountains are right behind us and it's snowy and it just feels like it's straight out of like a Folgers commercial. And we're actually here at Sundance because Dana and I, along with Julia Turner and Steve Metcalf from the Culture Gap Fest, did a live show together. And folks will actually hear, after we have this nice little lovely banter about our experience at Sundance, our interview with Sebastian Silva, who's a filmmaker who directed Tyrell, which is here at Sundance this year.
So yes, this is my first time in Utah, but I understand that both of you have been here before. So I thought it would be interesting for our listeners to kind of get a sense of what it means to be a film critic at Sundance. Aisha, do you want to start? So you've been here once before.
Well, I think Dana's been here more than I have, right?
This is only my second time.
Oh, so this is my
second time. The previous time I went, I was a judge. So I had a very unusual, like, strange experience of Sundance that's nothing like attending it as a festival goer or a critic, really.
Right. So I think we're actually both kind of on the same page because the last time I came, I was doing interviews, but we didn't have this podcast. We were actually here to do like video interviews, myself and my colleague Forrest Wickman. And that was interesting. It was a whirlwind. We were doing a lot more interviews then. We had an amazing booker, shout out to Raquel, who basically just got us tons of people. Even we had some people who we planned to interview ahead of time before we got to Sundance. And they, you know, we had those set up. But then once we got there, it was like, oh, there's more people here. Like, we wound up interviewing Guns N' Roses Slash. We wound up interviewing Slash because he like just happened to be around the corner. And a publicist was like, hey, Slash would love to talk about like horror movies. He loves to talk about horror movies. And so we were like, sure, we have time to talk to Slash for 10 minutes.
That's
so
nice.
Like, we talked to Slash. It was fun.
So is that what Sundance is like? Like, you just see celebrities everywhere?
I guess yes, I haven't seen that many since being here, but we also are kind of midweek. We only got here on Monday, and most of like the big stuff tends to happen on the first weekend and maybe even the second weekend. I think a lot of celebrities have left, but yes, if you go, especially if you go to certain movies premieres, there will be just packed like wall to wall with famous people. And that's what happened last time. I went to a few and it was like, oh, there's, I don't know. I can't remember what movies I saw at Sundance. This was 2015. It was a long time ago. But there were a lot of famous people. I don't know about you, Dana.
I'm so bad at celebrity spotting, whether here or in the streets of New York or anywhere. I'm always walking down the block and the person with me says, oh my God, so-and-so is right behind us, and I don't see the person. So we could be surrounded by famous people right now and I wouldn't be noticing.
And what does it mean to be a judge at Sundance?
Well, it was this very VIP experience, which was nice, but it was also extremely sheltered. They're really, really paranoid about, understandably, about any information leaking out. And I was the judge in the dramatic category, which is kind of, you know, the big prize. And so they kept us very cloistered. You weren't supposed to talk about the movies in any non-closed space, basically. You couldn't, for example, go with your fellow judges to a cafe after a movie and talk about it because somebody who worked on that movie could be sitting right there. So the idea was you either have to be in a hotel room where no one can hear you or inside a closed car. So that was, I got to know the other judges very well, which was fun. But really all there is time to do when you're judging at a film festival is see the movies you're judging and, you know, talk about them with your fellow judges. So it wasn't really the experience of going to Sundance and sort of being caught up in that whirlwind, which seems exhausting, but also exciting. That's the experience where you don't know what's going to happen, right? You could interview Slash, or you could suddenly run, jump into a movie that you'd never heard of and see the best movie of your life.
Yeah, yeah. It's those, like, surprises are always fun. I don't know if I've had that yet, that experience yet, but I've heard, I know people who go to this every year and they are like, yeah, I go into a movie and because it's a festival, most of these movies have not been anywhere else. So like you have little to go by except maybe who made it or who's in it. And then you go in and it's like a huge, it can be a huge surprise. It could be a huge letdown. It could be just something, a pleasant time in the theater. It could be all those things.
And Sundance in particular, maybe because it's early in the year and it kicks off the movie year, is sort of known for its energy and sometimes over enthusiasm of audiences, right? I mean, you know this phenomenon. There's movies that people swoon over at Sundance and then either they never get a deal and never get bought, or they come out and they bomb, or they come out and they're poorly reviewed, but they had all this energy when this audience was psyched up to see them at Sundance.
Why is that? Because I remember, I know, like, even The Birth of a Nation, like, was it Sundance that it got like a lot of praise and we thought it was going to be like this mega hit?
That's a good example. It got a standing ovation. I mean, of course, with that movie, it's different because of everything that rolled out after the movie, all of which actually could have been known before the movie, but no one talked about it until the release.
Well, you have to remember when that happened. It was 2016 and we were coming off of our second wave of Oscars So White. So it premiered right around the climate there. It was like, oh, this movie could save us. it can be like the savior. This is the movie that we've been waiting for that like will solve the Oscars next year. And obviously that was incredibly premature. And I think that's the huge main reason why that got a standing ovation before anyone had even seen it.
So let's talk a little bit about Utah itself. I know before I got here, everyone was telling me like, don't drink because of the altitude. And I've definitely felt like just walking up like Main Street, which is like the main street where all the theaters is. I've like Aisha, first of all, we went to lunch yesterday and she took us to like the furthest restaurant ever, which was like up a hill that kept going.
Okay. In New York terms, that would just be an avenue. I understand it was uphill.
It was like three avenues.
It was one avenue. It was not that far.
Anyway.
But maybe it's the oxygen.
But it is the oxygen. It is the oxygen. It was. It totally was. As soon as I got there and I sat down, walking down wasn't bad at all. I breezed by it.
It's funny. Like, it's been 3 years since the last time I was here, but the altitude hasn't affected me as much the second time, even though it's been a while. I do still get lightheaded, but I don't get out of breath like I did last time I was here. So yeah, it's just not affecting me in that way. So maybe this next time you come, it'll be better. What about you?
I haven't felt it in terms of breathing. I'm curious if whether either of you noticed it with drinking. They say that it goes to your head faster and you shouldn't get drunk at Sundance.
Oh,
because
does. Well, I'm much more conscious of drinking water while drinking alcohol than I usually am here because I think it does contribute to the lightheadedness even more. So
a lot of the movies you're seeing now, they're not going to come out. How long does it take? Sometimes it could be the same year. This is 2018. Sometimes it'll be longer than that, right?
I think it's rare that it's longer than a year.
I mean,
right?
Certainly the filmmakers come here hoping that it's going to be bought for this year. But because this is such a big industry festival, it really wildly varies, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there are things that are big hits at Sundance that get big deals, and they're saved to be Oscar movies. And in fact, that would probably be the dream of the filmmaker here, right? Your movie gets bought and it gets held for release until November, December.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't think... yeah, it, I feel like most, of, well, not most, but a lot of them get bought and then are usually rolled out within the first 6 months of the year.
So the movies that you're seeing now, they probably won't come out, not going to come out next month, right? So how do you write about it? How do you talk to people about it? Like, it's the kind of thing, like, you've seen it and no one else has. And so, like, if I got really excited about something and I know that I can't talk to anybody about it in depth, that would make me kind of sad. So how do you both deal with that?
Well, for Slate, I mean, maybe Aisha can answer this more than me because she's doing some actual coverage from this festival, right? You're doing some actual writing on films.
I'm planning to, yeah. I haven't yet, but yes.
But whereas this time I'm here for a live show, and if I see movies, I'll probably just bank them to write about later on. I mean, Slate is not hugely interested in festival coverage per se. We're not an industry film industry magazine, mm-hmm. and there's not a huge amount of interest for readers in reading about a movie you don't know when you can see.
Right? Yeah, I mean, Sam Adams, one of our culture editors, he also was at Sundance. He was here on the earlier part. And I know he's written at least two or three pieces. But one of them was a Q&A with a director, I believe. And then another one was like about the one movie that I think a lot of people are talking about. This movie, The Tale, which I'm hoping I can see, although it's not showing, I think, before we leave. It's about a woman wrestling with sexual abuse. And he basically, like, it shocked people, apparently. Like, audiences are really loving it, and so he wrote about it in that
sense. Laura Dern movie, right?
Yes, Laura Dern is in it, and the director is a woman. So it's things like that where we'll do that coverage, or if there's like an interesting Q&A after a screening, we might cover that. So but we don't do like generally straight up reviews of movies because no one is going to be able to see them. We save them for later. Places like Variety and The Hollywood Reporter, like trade magazines, do. And then like they also, I guess, republish them once the movie comes out. But we're not a trade magazine. So, and that's not our audience. Our audience doesn't really want to read a review about something they haven't seen, unless it's like a very specific, like, mm-hmm. cultural moment.
And for
me,
I don't love festival reviews. I mean, when you look at a review of a movie in one of those trade papers and you see, oh, this was written 9 months ago at Cannes or something like that, it to me takes away a little bit from the value of the review. And also means that the writing was probably rushed and the person didn't have any time to prep or research.
And finally, are there any themes? I'm looking at one of the movies Sam Adams covered, a documentary in which everything is a lie, and there's a picture of a Trump doll and a man drinking alcohol in front of him. And even the films that I've seen had either a very specific, this happened post-Trump, right? So are you seeing any other themes? Are you noticing the same theme that I'm seeing?
I mean, from the little I've seen so far, really, I've just seen the movie Tyrell that we talk about in the live podcast. And that very explicitly, it's the first movie I've seen that, you know, explicitly incorporates the election and has people talking about it. It's not an allegory or, you know, a hint or a suggestion. They just straight up talk about it. But I don't know if that's going to be a theme across the festival or not. I would imagine that that's going to be something over the next year, whether it was in time for this particular festival or not, but something that a lot of filmmakers try to turn to. Mm. Also, I think, I mean, as everywhere right now, I think representation is going to be a huge question. And maybe The Tale, for example, this movie directed by a woman that's about somebody revisiting their childhood sexual abuse, seems like a movie that's very much of the moment, and I can imagine it getting a good deal here and being something people really want to see.
Yeah, and the thing about that is that, like, I'm sure that movie was not, like, has been in the works for a while, and the Me Too movement, as we know it now, did not really didn't exist until about October. So it's funny how that timing works out. It feels sort of in the same vein as Get Out coming out right after Trump's election. It's like it just coincided very nicely with like this moment that we were having in a way that I'm sure the filmmakers could not have anticipated.
Because even if you don't, I mean, in this current Me Too moment as it exists, Trump was still elected as someone that had several sexual assault allegations, right? Cosby, I think, was on the minds of a lot of people.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like it's new, but I think obviously we were, at least for the Cosby thing, kind of came and went. And I don't remember many people paying that much attention to the trial when it was happening and over the summer, last summer. But I imagine that this summer there will be more attention being paid to that stuff in the wake of the Me Too stuff.
Well, thank you both for sharing your Sundance knowledge.
And that's, it's not a wrap from Sundance because you'll be hearing a segment of our live podcast next. But thank you so much, Dana.
Oh, thank you.
Up next, you'll hear Dana and I's conversation with Sebastian Silva, the director of Tyrell, from our live podcast that was sponsored by Dropbox. Also, there's a clip that we played at the live show in which the star of the movie, Jason Mitchell, is coerced into playing this very uncomfortable drinking game. Unfortunately, we weren't able to include it in this episode, but you can just imagine it and you'll probably hear it referenced by Sebastian Silva. So Tyrell is the latest film from filmmaker Sebastian Silva, known for his 2009 film The Maid, which also had its premiere here at Sundance. In it, Tyler, played by Jason Mitchell, tags along with his friend for a weekend birthday trip in the Catskills. Tyler is the only black person there amongst the group of buddies, and things become uncomfortable real quick. We have Sebastian Silva here to discuss Tyrell, so I'll bring him up now. Come on up. Welcome.
Hello, thank you.
Yeah, welcome. Hey. So as you might have been able to tell from the description, and I think you've probably heard this several times, but the premise of the film feels a little bit like Get Out. Another movie.
Many times.
Yes. You've heard this before. In terms of the, you know, black person going up into the woods and bad scary shit happens. What would you say to those who might dismiss your movie and say, oh, it just sounds like Get Out? Like, what about it? Makes it different and encourage everyone to go see your movie, because I think it's worth seeing.
I think whatever I say compared to Get Out is going to make people go less.
It's very different.
Like, there's people that's got what I was trying to do, and some people that has expected a little bit more for a payoff. That's kind of like the press being slightly divided by, like, what is the payoff of this movie, which is like a weekend of alienation of Tyler in a, and the alienation is set up by something that he does, which is like right after that scene, they're playing this game, saying that phrase with different accents, and when it comes black accent, it turns into like, they're like, come on, dude, be more specific, right? And they're like, he says, okay, a black woman from New Orleans, like an older black woman from New Orleans, and he's like, okay, and then they start like kind of passing the ball around until like Tyler does it himself, and he overdoes it, right? So when after he does this accent and overdoes it, and like it's too funny, right? And then he feels that he betrayed himself, and that's when he starts spiraling into this sort of identity crisis that is triggered by his own betrayal of his community, for instance, you know. And then the movie just follows his journey of alienation and this identity crisis without ever coming to a resolution, which is what I find the most upsetting, because there isn't, or it doesn't seem to be a resolution for this problem. And the movie, it's subtle, you know, like nobody is, I'm not pointing fingers, like I'm sort of kind of in my mind as a foreigner too, I'm sort of exposing a wound that you can sense in America, you know? And that is the one where it's a total claustrophobe for somebody like Tyler, you know, that he feels alienated and paranoid, and he's not exactly sure why.
Can you talk a little bit more about, you know, being you're from Chile, and what drew you to wanting to write about this sort of discomfort from the perspective of a black man, a black American man?
Right. Well, that's something like for a black American man, you know what I'm saying? It's Tyler. He's not a black man. I mean, he is a black man, but he's also Tyler before he is a black man. And that's why the movie is called that. And it's called Tyrell, because like somebody calls him that in the beginning, kind of goes unnoticed. But that's a microaggression. And the movie itself, or its title, it's a microaggression. And then a microaggression like that, it invites you to ask yourself if that could be forgiving, or at least contextualize and understand like what's the level of, what's the intention of that, and how much intentions play part in the microaggressions, you know, etc. But going back to your question, I was with a friend in Cuba at the beach, and there was like this group of 20 years something old kids from America drinking rum at the bottle and being loud, playing frisbee. And one of them was black. And it seemed that he was very kind of alienating and following behind. And at some point I was like, oh, look, he's not as drunk. And then he was very drunk and it looked like he was pretending to be drunk. And that could have been anybody. And it would just be somebody that was feeling awkward at that time with a group of people. But the fact that he was black, it added a whole new layer to his discomfort. And I think that's when the wound that I'm talking about comes to the surface, you know, that it's not only that, it can never be only that he's feeling uncomfortable because maybe he drank too much or they were weird to him. It's always going to be that layer, like the race factor, you know, and it could be very confusing, I assume, you know, and it is very confusing for Tyler in this movie. And that's why I'm not giving it away because it's not a movie about plots, but that's why he cries at the end and he's drunk and he's like, I don't know what's going on. Like, I really cannot pinpoint it.
And can you dig a little bit more into just, in terms of getting into Tyler's head, like, how did you, was this something you worked on with Jason?
Yeah.
In sort of sussing out, was there improvisation involved? Like, just from your perspective, how did you come at that in the script and what we eventually see in the final mm-hmm. product?
I think alienation is really one of my number one subjects in my movies. If you've seen my movies, like in Magic, The Maid, you know, Crystal Fairy even, all of those movies, alienation plays a huge role. It's really something that fascinates me because I think I've suffered that from that a lot. And I think that the society that we live now, it's so alienated that everybody is like that. Everybody feels slightly paranoid at a Sundance party, you know. I can see it, guys. We're all freaking out inside. But like it truly, like alienation is so that kind of ran by mice. I was like, this is such a great example of alienation. And on top of that, or like parallel to that, like I'm making a comment on race in America that I feel that I haven't seen yet, because everything that I've seen mostly like in movies or TV shows, like, it's not on the nose as a bad thing, but it doesn't, but it always feels that I always agree with everything. Whenever there is, you know, a movie about slavery, like, of course you're going to be on the side of the victim. It's impossible not to. You would have to be a monster, you know? But then when the victimizers are not intentionally victimizers, then you start, I don't know, like finding other angles to things. And that's what happened with Tyrell, and then I forgot the question. I'm so sorry. I totally forgot.
It kind of leads into a question I was going to ask, actually, which is about improv. She was asking if Jason Mitchell, Tyrell, did improv. And I've read that you do use a lot of improv
yes.
in your sets.
This movie was crazy because I had tried to make a movie in the Caribbean about a family, and the man that was going to play the father role, which was the main role, bailed out like a week before shooting. So I'm like, fuck Hollywood and fuck the movie stars. This is not right. So I was very disenchanted. And then I was in Cuba sort of with my friend spending New Year's, and we saw this and I'm like, I want to make a movie about something simple like this. I love this. Is I want to do it. Like I just want. And he's like, you can use my house in the Catskills, man. I'm like, we got it. Like, that's all I needed, a house. And then I just called my friends. I called Michael Cera, Chris Abbott, and like, well, some friends of mine that are not even actors are there. Like, the payoff for the house was like, I'll put you in the movie. So my friend Nico is in the movie. And then somebody, I had an idea for who was going to play Tyler. It's very important, you know? Like, it's a very tricky subject. And like, for me, it was a huge deal. A lot of people warned me not to do it too. That made me even want to make it more.
Why, like, what did they
say? Because they were like, you're not a black man. You cannot portray the black experience. And I'm like, yes, I can. No, but I was like, I know what you're saying, but like, I've been alienated, you know? And this is going to be a collaboration too. And like, it's a subject that as a foreigner, it's like, it's deep enough and it's clear enough. And I live in New York. I've been there for 16 years. And like, you see it all the time. You really see it all the time, and it's been proven here. When I show this movie, like, strangely enough, like, black women have approached me, and they're, like, really thankful that this is being portrayed in this way because it's a day-to-day thing that they go through. And, like, and look, I know that hate people sometimes hate comparing minorities because they really all have their own context, right? But as a gay person, I also live that, you know, that you are kind of gay before you are Sebastian, you know, and like that level, like it's something that we're going to have to live with. And it's really sad that the black community has to live with for who knows how many more generations, if not forever, same as gay people, you know. And at least I'm not, and this movie doesn't come up with a resolution because it's not looking for an answer, but it's pointing that out. It's saying like, look, this is, we're living two separate things here. Like, oh my God. Oh my God, they're here.
It's one of the animals falling from the...
I have nothing to do with that. But yeah, Jason was incredible. Like truly Jason is like as real as it gets. And he doesn't hold grudges, but he's also politically conscious and just very generous. And like, I think this movie could have gone really wrong if like the person that I collaborated with wasn't confident enough to do the role and to go for it. And it was a collaboration. I was more in charge, of course, of the journey, the emotional and psychological journey of this character, and Jason together with me on that, but he also had the somehow responsibility that I handed to him to contextualize this this sort of social issue or this wound, you know, like, and he did great, and he was like, I want to find the most sort of like nuanced average sort of black man that I can, and like this to just to portray that this is such a daily common problem, and it's not minimal. It is people live under this that stress, you know, and it's and people should be aware of it at least. And then again, the movie doesn't propose a solution, you know. And going back to the very, very first question about Get Out, that is like, it's not as satisfying because those white people dying, it's so satisfying in that movie. And like, and that is really fucked up. I gotta say it, like, you cannot be happy because white people are being killed. Like, but we are. So what is, there's something going on, you know? And like, I don't know, I think things have gone like weird directions because of this, you know? Yeah, I have more examples, but I don't wanna be too controversial. Or should I? Who said yes? Woo! No, but like, okay, I'm gonna get there. Please forgive. Please don't make my
life.
Do
it. Do it.
No, no, but I was told I wasn't here. But I think that for The Birth of a Nation, I heard that before the movie played, there was a standing ovation, right? And that to me talks so much about like white guilt and sort of this patronizing approach to the black community. You know, because if you haven't seen a movie, don't clap, dude. Like, watch the movie, see if you like it, then you clap. Like, and I wouldn't like that people clap at my movie because I'm anything. I just want them to watch the movie, you know? And I feel that white people cheering when they see white people getting killed and also white people clapping at a movie they haven't seen is just complete psychosis. And it's like, we need a way out. And I think conversation, it's really the way out. And I've noticed among my white liberal friends that they're terrified, really, to express themselves when it comes to race. And with all reason, too, because there's never the right thing to say. And, like, everybody can be easily crucified, you know. And, like, people are just terrified. And, like, I include myself because I live here, but she's like, we need to fucked up to... As intentions matter a little bit, you know, like, and if you don't have bad intentions and you're still ignorant, which is really most of people when it comes to this subject, it feels that there is this void of knowledge and confidence to talk about it. And it's only creating all of these weird behaviors, you know?
Well, here's one distinction you could make between what you're doing and what a more kind of traditionally suspenseful movie like Get Out is doing is that you have a lot of ambiguities that are never resolved and that are left very uncomfortable at the end, and I won't spoil what any of those are, but I mean, I'm presuming that you want to leave your audience in that state of kind of suspended ambiguity at the end.
Yeah, very much. I mean, it's like, I think that it's only so terrifying that something would end up with a shitty selfie. Like, it talks so much about how the problem is being addressed to me, you know, and like That I find very tragic. And that to me is it's a big payoff, because we are really numb. We're really numb to blood. We're numb to death. So anything that ends with death or ends with somebody in jail or somebody crying hysterically over a dead body or somebody laughing while exploded an atomic bomb, like, we're so numb to those things. Like, I don't get emotional with that kind of stuff, you know? Like, it hits me there because it could be gory or could be emotionally very intense, but it doesn't sit with me. Like, I want questions. I don't want, like, mediocre pyrotechnical solutions that are not solutions, you know, are just sort of a necessity to vent and to just, like, but I'm a really big fan personally of doubts, and like I want to be challenged, and I think contradictions is all we got, and that's why this movie is so unsatisfying for people that are looking for that payoff, because in my mind the payoff is there, but it's not the payoff you expect. And like, it might sound very judgy, but I feel that people that don't see or cannot feel the pain that Tyler is feeling in this movie and don't consider that enough pain are very sort of insensitive to the day-to-day struggle that the Black community goes through, truly. Like, I don't think you need to see a slave whipped to death to understand the pain. The pain is in front of you. It's when you walk into a restaurant, it's everywhere. You can see it, you know? So that was my approach. And I remember the Safdie brothers. I don't know if you're familiar with their work. They made
Good Time.
Heaven's Not Wide and Good Time. And they were like, make it explode, man. Like, come on, make Tyler do something. You like maybe even talk about this with somebody. And I really resisted the temptation to succumb to that payoff that now people are asking for. So, there you go.
I had a more kind of career-encompassing question for you, because I sort of saw this movie as part of a trilogy with, I don't know if they're your last three in a row, but three of your recent films, which were The Crystal Fairy, Magic Magic, and this one, Tyrell, all of which oddly also co-star Michael Cera as a somewhat malevolent, possibly violent figure. But those three movies made this kind of trilogy of entrapment, because they're all about people that are outsiders in some way, a woman among men, right? A foreigner among Chilean, an American among Chileans, and a Black man among white men, and shows them sort of trapped in a social situation that's awkward and possibly dangerous. They're kind of similar in that way. I don't know if you conceived of it as that, but
they really are. I mean, they do relate in that sense, and I feel that this movie relates to Nasty Baby in the sense that I wasn't sure with Nasty Baby what were the morals of my story. Like, I was not completely sure how I felt about my characters at the very end. I'm like, it's a movie where, like, these hipsters from Brooklyn get away with murder and of a homeless man that lives in their street. And it's a whole sequence of things that ends with them, like, getting rid of a body and, like, seemingly getting away with it. And, like, it's a movie, like, feel of ambiguity. And I think that those two also relate very much, Tyrell and Nasty Baby, in the sense that I'm like passing the ball. You know, I think really Tyrell, the movie exists so much within the set of prejudices and conditioning of the audience. And I mean, like, I confess this movie was like specially made for Americans. Like, I was like, I'm gonna make something for them. Like, I don't think this movie is gonna play nicely as an anthropological maybe study in Europe, you know, if it's shown at Cannes, people will understand it, but nobody lives it more deeply than Americans. And I confirmed that in the screenings. Like, I was very impressed by the reaction. Like, it was like a little hurtful, actually, to even like walk on stage. People were like, what? But it's good. Like, I think in my mind, it's a conciliatory movie. And I'm not trying to create any more device. Can you imagine? Yeah. And also, they stab a trampiñata with a machete, if you're into that.
Always a plus in any movie.
Yeah, I mean, why not, right?
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you guys so much. Yeah,
thanks, Sebastian.
It.
Thank you.
And that's a wrap. You'll find links to everything we discussed on our show page. Represent is produced by the lovely, awesome Verlyn Williams, and our special live segment was also produced by Benjamin Frisch. Our excellent social media assistant is Marissa Martinelli, and special thanks to Faith Smith and Kirsten Holtz for helping to coordinate the event. And again, thank you to Dropbox. Until next time.